Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast. I'm Claire Armistead.
I'm Richard Lee.
And I'm Sian Kane.
We have the skinny, the scoop, and the surprise of this year's overall Costa Book of the Year award. And it's not who you'd think.
And I'm delighted to announce that the winner of the 2018 Costa Book of the Year is The Cutout Girl by Bar Van Ness.
Yes, we were totally wrong in thinking it would inevitably be Sally Rooney. But we like to think we were also totally right in giving you the early heads up on Bart Van Ness in our interview with him last week. We'll have more on the shock Costa winner later on.
And history was made when Thomas Page McBee stepped into a boxing ring at Madison Square Gardens for a fight. But why?
But first, you know us, always lounging around in comfy chairs reading books. Except not, definitely not this week. You've been out and about rushing around all over the world, haven't you, Claire and Sian? Where have you been off to?
Yes, I've been to Calcutta, where I was a judge on the DSC Prize for South Asian Literature, which we gave to Jayant Kaikini, another surprise winner, because he is a writer in the Kannada language and translated by Tejaswini Neranjana. And this is a minority language which hasn't even been translated into other Indian languages, let alone into English. Mm. And as Tejaswini pointed out, Jayant is not, he actually is writing in his second language because his actual language is Karnataka. But there is not a written script for it, so they have to write in Kannada.
So it's almost doubly translated.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's so fitting because it's the first translated winner of that prize.
Yeah, and it's a collection, a short story collection called No Presents Please, and it's all about Bombay. And so this is supposedly a prize for novels, but we made the point that actually it was making a novel of the city of Bombay, but it's looked at very much from the margins, from the small people who come in and live small lives. It's not the grandiose metropolitan story that we tend to hear about these great Asian cities. So I was absolutely thrilled that he won. He had an incredibly stiff field, including Carmila Shanzi, Mohsin Hamid, Neil Mukherjee, and it just felt like the right person at the right time.
A book that needed a bit more attention.
Yes, absolutely. But I mean, it's not that it needs a bit more attention. It should get more attention.
And how about you, Sian? Where have you been to?
So I went to Indonesia for a week, which was it's basically part of every year we have London Book Fair, which is sort of very industry facing. So members of the public don't necessarily get to go to London Book Fair, but it tends to be a place where lots of the decisions are made about the books that will be published each year. And so each year London Book Fair chooses a different country to sort of elect as their market focus. And this year it was Indonesia. So this basically means that for the first time, we actually probably see a bit of a groundswell of Indonesian writing being translated into English, because there's really not very much being translated into English up till this point. So I went to Jakarta for a week and met a whole bunch of authors who will all be coming to London later in the year to meet publishers.
And sign book deals at the London Book Fair.
Yeah, exactly.
And so who were the authors that were most exciting that you met?
Well, there's one particular author who I'm actually looking forward to speaking to quite a lot more. I spent about an hour with him and he's just had such an incredible life. His name is Seno Gumira Ajidama and he is a quite well-known journalist there. But he presents a lot of his journalism as sort of short stories and sort of satirical takes on really genuinely troubling things in Indonesian society, so corruption and censorship, and he's had quite a lot of run-ins with governments before, and he's a bit of a rock star, so hopefully we'll be able to see more of his books in English. There's also a great young writer called Intan Paramedita. She's Indonesian, but she's actually based in Sydney, and she has her first short story collection coming out in April with Harvil Secker, which is called Apple and Knife. And it's sort of kind of like a Daisy Johnson style look at womanhood, but in a sort of disgusting, sort of horrific lens.
Is that set back in her old country? Is that now in Australia?
A lot of it is Indonesian society, and she sort of uses a lot of mythology. And the first story in the collection is sort of a Indonesian version of Cinderella. So a lot of body horror, but a lot of sort of very interesting sort of points about sort of the female position in society, particularly in a country like Indonesia, which is both very diverse and multicultural, but also has its roots really as a sort of Islamic country.
Grounded in all that hot, wet weather.
Yeah, exactly. that's really exciting, and that'll be out in April.
And you're off again next week, aren't you, Claire?
Yeah, I'm off to Cartagena, where Hay has an outpost. I have actually been before, and it's the most brilliant, brilliant place and a wonderful festival. And there'll be people like Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Zadie Smith, Philippe Sands, Rosie Boycott. So a lot of discussion. I'm expecting a lot of discussion around the environment and around the what they call the orange economy. There's different ways of coping with where we are now. I've literally been 3 days in the UK, and I'm now off in the opposite to an opposite time zone. So goodness knows how I'm going to be. I have to take my gummy melatonin sweets.
To which
Sian introduced me.
Somebody who sound like a drug dealer or something. Now, regular listeners will know that there's nothing we love more than a bit of book prize speculation. The Costas give us double rations because not only do we get 5 category winners to mull over, but one of those 5 gets chosen as overall book of the year. 2 weeks ago, we were talking about this and we firmly placed our hats on Sally Rooney winning for Normal People, and we were wrong.
Well, the thing is, we were sort of slightly begging this to happen because there is a history of the absolute front runner falling at the last hurdle. I mean, look at Zadie Smith. You know, it took ages for her to win anything. Mm.
But it's the sort of thing. It's not like Bart Van Ness's Cutout Girl isn't entirely deserving of the prize.
No,
but there is a sort of sense that Sally Rooney's Normal People really was a book of the year last year. That it was, and it hasn't really won anything prominent, despite being nominated for basically everything.
But maybe the two are connected. I mean, I think sometimes panels feel that if a book has already got attention, that they have the flexibility to give it to another book, which is very deserving, as you say, but hasn't been so widely read.
Mm. It's got this fantastic story surrounding it, you know, right up to the fact that Lean, the girl who the story is told, who was 8 years old when Bart Van Ness's grandparents took her in the Netherlands during the Second World War, was there aged 85 to receive the prize.
Without families, you don't get stories. And I found that so deeply in the process of researching and writing this book. It's a book really about, ultimately, my love for Lean, who is here.
I won't share without family, I have no story. But I have a story, thank you, Bart. And I also have kind of family again.
So that was Lean. It must have been a really extraordinary evening for her. You know, this is somebody who had lost contact with this family who'd sheltered her during the war after a bust up over actually a very mundane thing, who has created this new family, has come back into orbit with the grandson of the people who took her in. What he does that's so clever is that he counterpoints the horror which is going on in the background. Lean's parents were killed. She was an abandoned child who did suffer terrible abuses from rogues among the people who were looking after her. And yet she has made a good life, and yet things continue. There are normal people in horrible, abnormal circumstances.
And how does he go about giving this kind of this feeling of the detail that underpins this life?
It's very calm, his writing, and it's very observant of very small details. Now, we're going to have a reading that he gave us when he came in for an interview, which you'll see exactly what I mean. He focuses on, in this case, on a picture of a duck. And what he says is the picture of the duck has no meaning except for its history. Once you have its story, you understand that it's not just a picture of a duck. Mm. And I suppose, you know, in a way, it's quite Sibaldian, his writing, in that sense, the way that it teases out the meaning of commonplace things.
So this is a point from midway in the book where I'm starting to uncover this network of resistance that actually went on in my mother's home village, which also I didn't know about and none of her family knew about. So this is me waking up in my grandparents' house, not the grandparents who looked after Lean, but another set. In Bennekom the next morning, I wake up to an empty house. My aunt and uncle, Jan Willem and Sabrina, must have left for work hours earlier. Even their dogs are missing. A note on the kitchen worktop tells me that the neighbour will collect them at 8, which means that they must have left more than an hour ago. I sit with the newspaper, eating breakfast. At the far end of the sunlit room, a large window stretches up to the ceiling, which follows the triangular pitch of the roof. It frames a cluster of pines across the lawn. The house, a spacious low-rise, was built by my maternal grandparents immediately after the war and embodies their faith in the modern, clean-lined and inspired by the American architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright. It sits on a wooded hill just outside the village. A privileged child, I spent my summers here in the 1970s and 1980s, enjoying the huge garden and the swimming pool with my brother and my cousins. The place feels different now, after hearing Lean's story last night. The newspaper that I'm reading is the NRC for the 14th of January, 2015. Its front cover shows a long line of people in Paris, the Arc de Triomphe right behind them, queuing for copies of the magazine Charlie Hebdo. From a circulation of less than 100,000, it has run to 5 million copies for its first edition since the attacks. Inside the papers, there are photographs of the Empire State Building and the National Gallery in London, both lit up in the colours of the French flag. And under the headline, Terror in Europe, the shooting in Paris is described as an act of war. Articles and opinion pieces set out the threat to Jewish life in many countries, with synagogues closed as a precaution in case of attack. There is talk of mass emigration. More than 7,000 Jews left France for Israel just last year, one of the reports in the newspaper tells me, and numbers are on the rise. Lean's history and these recent terror attacks sit so strangely alongside the familiar house that surrounds me, the parquet flooring, the stylish modern and antique furniture, and the huge speakers of the quad stereo system on which classical music was always playing when I was a child. On the wall by the door, there is a little pencil sketch of a duck in a pond with some reeds around it, perhaps 10 centimetres across. A few nights ago, I learnt that this picture was given to my uncle's great-aunt by her Jewish neighbours just before they were transported to the East. Like almost all the 107,000 Dutch Jews who went through the transit camp at Westerbork, the neighbours never came back. That is why the little sketch is now in my family's possession. As I look at the picture, I'm reminded of Lean's first observation about stories and families. This square of pencil lines is not even a scrap of information. Without the family story, it could end up in a junk shop if there was nobody left to tell. I reflect that for me, Bennekom has never really had history. It always felt so modern and has had associations only with a happy youth. It feels different now.
See, I ask you to read that passage because it sort of sends chills up and down my spine. I love that idea of a little picture, pencil drawing of a duck, meaning nothing until it has its history. And as soon as its story comes, is given to it, it means everything.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's sort of what you've done with this book, isn't it? You're giving back the history to areas of the Netherlands which don't know their own history.
There's this sort of mania for modernisation in the Netherlands.
And also because it did sustain a huge amount of damage.
Yes,
absolutely. So Rotterdam is almost entirely post-war, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, certain parts of the Netherlands sustained huge amounts of damage. I mean, Rotterdam absolutely flattened and the railway lines were really stripped by the Germans in the last part of the war. I mean, actually quite a lot of the rest of the Netherlands was entirely unaffected.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.
Most of the great cities outside of Rotterdam were not bombed, but they sort of feel just so well kept and so modern that it doesn't feel like the kind of presence of a history that you get in Britain, where I sort of think, you know, everything rattles, people are continually talking about the war.
Bart Vanesse's The Cutout Girl is published by Fig Tree, and you can of course hear the entire interview by scrolling back in the podcast feed. Next up, Thomas Page McBee, after this.
Today in Focus is a new Guardian podcast that brings you closer to our journalism by getting behind the news every weekday. You'll join me, Anushka Astana, talking to people at the centre of the big stories impacting our world. We'll use personal perspectives and expert analysis to put you at the heart of what matters. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to listen.
Thomas Page McBee's 2014 memoir, Man Alive, told the story of the abuse he suffered from his father and his transition during his 20s to a male identity. But his journey wasn't finished, was it, Richard?
No, not at all. This is one of the reasons why his latest book, Amateur, is so fascinating. It's kind of beyond the point of arrival, then what happened next? It tells about how he discovered that as his body was changing, people's reactions to him were changing as well. If he was in a meeting at work, he found people listened differently. He only had to start speaking with his new lower voice and the room was suddenly silent in a way that never happened to him before. And he found that people assumed he was competent in a way that hadn't happened before either. And so instead of people demanding that he prove that he could do something, people would assume that he would be able to do it because he had the potential to do it. And they would promote him much more quickly than he had been discovering before. And also, I mean, the kind of things that he was doing when he was living as a woman in terms of asserting himself. So he would, like, talk over somebody. They had a totally different meaning if he talked over a woman in his new body than in his old body.
Now, last year, I read a lot of transgender things. We had a couple of interviews on this podcast. And I seem to remember saying that I didn't feel that it had found its literary voice. There were an awful lot of memoirs, but it's like the first draft of writing. Do you think that Thomas Page McBee is lifting the literature of transgender to a different level?
I'm not sure if he's doing anything that's particularly new in a kind of literary sense, but what he's doing is he's moving on, as it were, to the next phase. I mean, we've heard, as you say, many people talking about their journey from one identity to the next, but then he's now exploring, so now I'm here, what happens next? I mean, he found that he started getting into fights as well with men, and indeed, this is, I think, the spur for the book, because he wanted to look that in the eye and look what it meant to actually be in this body and to find himself reacting with violence when violence was presented. And he started asking himself questions about that. In fact, when he came to the studio, I asked how an argument about a photo in 2015 pitched him into this sequence of events that led him into a boxing ring.
Yeah, so I mean, actually, I would say that the argument about the photo is actually rooted even further back, which was in 2011, which is when I began my transition. And so when I began my transition, I was reporting on the masculinity crisis, but I was also sort of going through my own masculinity crisis.
Kind of living it.
Yes, yeah. Living it. And what I mean by that is, on one hand, I was experiencing all of these privileges I'd never had before. So I was, like, I would be in my apartment having a, you know, feeling it in my body in a way I never had. And then I would leave the apartment and it was like, you know, I would get to work and I would realize that if I spoke, I would interrupt a woman just by, like, speaking, period. Like, I would silence the room, you know?
Yeah, the fact of the voice was enough.
Exactly, right. Or I was getting promotions in ways that were really fast and sort of, I would say, lubricated, it felt like. Like, everything was, for me, it was happening in this way that was the opposite of my experience before. So, and then also, like, I was a threat by accident. Like, I would walk down the street at night and I, you know, a woman would cross to the other side to avoid me. So on one hand, there were these sort of ways that I was, I guess, gaining a place in the world. And then on the other hand, I was feeling this sense of constriction. Like, that was really intense. So, like, what sociologists call the man box. I was expected to behave a certain way. And as I was meeting that expectation every day, it felt like whether or not I wanted to, it was sort of happening to me. So for example, in 2014, when my mom died, I was having grief, as you do, and I felt like it was almost impossible for me to sort of express that to anyone around me because I felt like I could only be angry, you know?
That was the only option.
Yes,
if you had an emotion, it had to be anger.
Right. Yeah. It was very hard to sort of, you know, outside of my most close personal relationships, to show how I was really feeling. And that constriction, you know, was lining up with a lot of what I was witnessing in the men around me, and also what I was hearing about through my reporting around, like, the, you know, skyrocketing, you know, suicide rates amongst men, especially men who were out of work, which had a lot to do with, you know, their sense of status as men. And so all of that was sort of the tornado of my own experience that was happening on this day on Orchard Street. And, you know, my mom had just died a few months before. And it was the third time in 3 months that I had this experience of a guy out of nowhere wanting to have a street fight with me. And because I was maybe walking around with a lot of rage grief, I wonder if maybe they were picking up on it. But this last time, it was just so extreme. Like, I went downstairs to get ice cream at the bodega down the street. It's a very Manhattan thing to do. And I walked by this restaurant that I thought looked really cool, and I took a picture of it because I wanted to take my girlfriend there. And the flash was on by accident, and it bounced back, and this guy just came tearing out of nowhere, and he, you know, he thought I took a picture of his car, or did he? I don't even know. I don't think
that
so.
That was enough of an excuse.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. You know,
whatever.
I mean, right, it didn't matter. I mean, he wanted to have this fight with me, and it went on and on and on, this exchange, and part of why it went on, I think, is because I didn't totally want to let it go. I was mad. I was frustrated.
You could feel that inside you as well.
Yes, and so... Anyway, it almost came to blows, and then it didn't because I, you know, I kind of like yelled at him, and he ended up thinking I seemed a little bit crazy, and so he walked away. But what that left me with was this sense of, like, you know, I am like hurtling towards becoming this guy. Like, this is who I'm going to be if I don't start asking serious questions about, like, why this is happening to me. And as someone who's trans, the whole point was to try to, you know, live my life on my own terms and be embodied in a way that felt good. And I just felt like that wasn't happening for me. So the way I chose to deal with it was to start asking questions, because I felt like, as a man, the first thing I learned was you can't ever question masculinity, you know, like Fight Club. So my question was, why do men fight? And that's how I got into boxing.
Because boxing is just kind of where it's happening. It's fighting right there.
Right. It's fighting. And, you know, I've always been a boxing fan. I think boxing has this very literary reputation for good reason, in the sense that there's something so, you know, pure, I guess, about a person being in a ring against another person. And even if you just have a passing interest in fighting, you can turn on the TV, see a fight, and you can see, like, every vulnerability in both fighters, you know? It's very clear, like, what both people are struggling with. So I guess, to me, it felt like a very, very just, I guess, distilled way to engage that question.
Was there a part of you that also wanted to learn some skills to fight back with?
Yes, of course. Definitely. I did. But that was part of, I think, what I was thinking of as the shadow in the Jungian sense. Like, you know, I really, of course, I felt a sense of wanting to commit violence to this man. And that was part of what was distressing me. But I feel like the advice I was getting from the men around me was, you know, well, you're not that kind of guy, or guys are just like that, or whatever. There was no narrative for, like, but what about the part of me that wants to do this? Like, and how do I confront that part so that I don't do it in a way that is troubling and problematic? And so shining a light on it, I think, meant being honest with myself about, you know, what was really happening there.
At the same time, you say that your new body was giving you new kind of respect, it was lubricating things for
Yes. You.
Was it also a way of putting yourself back in a position of being a novice?
Yeah. Definitely.
Kind of like learning thing. Like, yeah. Here I am again, learning.
Yeah. But I think what was so interesting is, you know, for me as a young person, I was a really, like, androgynous kid. I don't think I really, in any kind of sort of formal way, felt affiliated with the gender I was born. So I was always sort of this androgynous person. And I definitely was socialized, because we all are, you know, to some degree or another. But I never experienced the world in such a legible identity. So I think suddenly being this thing where it was bizarre for me to, like, walk into a restaurant and have there be, like, you know, okay, I get the check. Like, you know, I just never had that experience. Like, it was, and so those things were...
It had always been more complicated.
More complicated, yeah. You know? And so I think, I guess to me, it seemed very much like there were two ways to handle that. One way was to sort of just accept it and maybe feel a little weird about it, but at the end of the day, be like, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's easy to say I'm trans and you know, I'm the person I wanted to be, and that was the hard work, and now I'm just going to sort of fade into
done.
The night. Yes, yeah, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's the story in media often about trans people. Like, it's triumphant. We do it. We're done. Mm. But to me, I just felt like it. What would have been the point of all of this if then at the end of the day, I'm spending time and, you know, as a person in the world feeling dissonant in a totally different way. And so, yes, I felt like being a man, and as I learned once I talked to sociologists and psychologists, that this is a universal feeling. But for me, it felt like I'm not supposed to ask questions. I'm not supposed to ever doubt myself or think, why am I doing this, or why am I expected to do this? But it was my natural instinct as a beginner to do just that, and I wanted to capitalize on it.
I guess one of the other things that we're taught not to question, one of the things that a very powerful myth is the myth of testosterone.
Oh, yes.
But again, it's just more complicated than that.
It is. It's my favorite. You know, so the book is set up as a series of questions that I ended up asking myself like as I was training, and I really committed fully and sometimes embarrassingly to and sometimes in a way that frightened me to really reporting out each question. And so the question I was most afraid of was the question of, does testosterone make you violent? Because, I mean, I come from violence. I was abused growing up and experienced male violence. And I really was afraid that I don't know, would in some way become destined to have this potential in a way.
That you were literally injecting it into yourself. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which was scary. But, you know, so that one I kind of held off the longest on asking about. But I called up Robert Sapolsky, who is a Stanford neuroscientist, a really famous Stanford neuroscientist who lived with primates for a year and a very well-respected man. And he told me that, this is my favorite fact, actually, I think I learned throughout the whole book, was that testosterone doesn't cause aggression. There's no such thing as an aggression receptor in the brain. That's not a thing. But what it does cause, as far as, you know, they can tell around like chimps and so on, is status seeking. And so they run economic games where in order to win the game, you have to cooperate. And so in those games, the men with the highest testosterone levels are the winners always. But if you give a guy a shot and you tell him it's testosterone, but it's a placebo, those guys act like jerks. So obviously the way we perceive sex as testosterone,
it's the myth.
Yes, it's the myth. Yeah. And that doesn't make it less, you know, powerful. Like, I think sometimes we talk about nature and nurture as if it's like nature is the powerful thing and nurture is the like really easily changeable thing. And sure, but culture is really powerful.
Yeah, it's the intersection of the two that's really poisonous.
Exactly, yeah.
Another complication, I guess, is that when you got to the gym, you didn't tell people about your history. You didn't tell them you were trans. Why not?
I think for two reasons. One was that I wasn't sure how people might react. So just from a safety perspective, I really wanted...
Literally safety.
Yes, absolutely. It's a very intimate space, obviously, in terms of, you know, just you're sort of in these like subterranean, you know, dank spaces with a bunch of mostly men in these like locker rooms that have no privacy.
Big, powerful men.
Yes, yeah. Big, powerful men who then you fight. so I just wasn't so sure how that might be received. And that was one. But more than that, I would say I was really interested in not... I've always been very out, and I wanted to not have this be a mediating factor for people in terms of how they treated me, especially because I intended to write, this was first, you know, a story that I was writing for Quartz, and I really wanted to not spend the whole time wondering about if I'm being treated differently and, like, you know, in terms of reporting out the story. So that was really...
It was a kind of
driving.
Methodological thing as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Is it also partly about the fact that every story is an individual? I mean, you say that you weren't passing as a man in the gym because you are a man, but
yes.
Your brain, you say, was grooved by moving through the world in your before body. So
yes.
No one else in the gym had the same kind of story as yours.
Right.
But isn't the point that nobody has the same kind of story as anybody else?
Of course. And I was thinking a lot about passing. You know, the book is sort of tortured around that. I think I felt very strange about, you know, because I'm such an open book and I really appreciate the potential to walk around and say, this is who I am all the time. But over time, I realized there are people in this gym who have stories that, you know, as I was learning a little bit about everyone, I found out things I had no idea or never would have expected, you know. And so the passing that was happening in that gym was happening in everybody, yeah, which is also what's happening in life, you know. So I think I sort of over time got like I let that go as an anxiety or a fear because it felt like we were all in the same situation, but just from different backgrounds.
It's the part of the problem in the US that men are defined in a binary opposition with women rather than as in Denmark, as you say, being manhood right. being defined in opposition to boyhood. Is part of the problem to look for other binaries, or is it just junk the binaries?
Yeah, I mean, I think binaries, for me anyway, whenever I see one, I'm suspicious. You know,
yeah, that's the general rule.
Yes, because I think all of our humanity comes from nuance, you know? And when you see something where you're being presented with two choices, unless it's really truly like, you know, I don't know, on a restaurant menu, I'm concerned about why and who. It's a power dynamic, right? One choice has to become the more powerful choice. Like a thing about that's also in the book that I've thought about a lot since is this idea of good men and bad men. So in the US, I don't know if you say this here, but there's a lot of like, you know, am I a good man or he's a good man? And this sort of designation of being good, which is moral, it's a moral designation. And it's usually in reference to like this like Me Too, you know, culture of like, this guy is the good guy. He would never do this. He would never be sexually violent. He would never be sexual harasser. He would never be a predator.
That's right. Trump was saying that Kavanaugh's a good guy. He's a
exactly,
good man.
Yes. And
so it's impossible that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And it's such a, I mean, flawed logic on a basic level, obviously. But what happens is it becomes, first of all, it's a binary. So for there to be good men, there have to be bad men. So that's a strange way to set this whole conversation up. But also, I talked to the psychologist Niobe Wei from NYU, who I spoke to for my book, and we were discussing this, and she said to me something I really love, and I've thought about, I think, every day since, where she said, instead of asking yourself if you're a good man, ask yourself, how am I maintaining the status quo? And I thought that that was such a better way of framing it, because I think the truth is we are all maintaining the status quo in ways that we're often surprised by when we think about them. But once it's illuminated for us, we can change it, you know, if you don't like the status quo, which I think a lot of people currently don't.
It's not perfect, is it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it gives you a little more freedom to sort of have a more empowered relationship with your own life and with your own body. That's not about proving to the external world, oh, I'm so good, so don't look at me, I've got it all figured out. And that's also setting you up to fail, because certainly no one's good all the time. So it's much better to have an ongoing growth relationship with yourself.
I guess one of the things that the trans mode of existence offers everybody is mm-hmm. the idea that we don't have to play the roles we've been assigned.
Yes, of course, as does feminism. I mean, right? Like, as does many, many ways in which, like, anyone who is from a marginalized identity who has sort of highlighted for the rest of us, you know, I mean, this happens around race too, like, why is this the neutral? Why is this way of behaving the way that we've decided is the right way, or the way that, you know, everything has to be? Like, and in fact, in my feeling, like, the more we can expand out our definitions of what's possible, like, the more liberated we all are in our identities. This scarcity mentality actually has a lot to do with toxic masculinity, because protecting one way of being is how we keep it consistent, keep the same people in power always.
And is one of the ways in which these definitions could be expanded, is one of the ways through kind of science fiction, technology, biology. I'm thinking of the kind of the multiple identities that people in science fiction stories put on their own bodies, these kind of alien gender yeah. mashups that you find right. in M. John Harrison or in. Is that one of the ways that we can imagine a future?
Well, maybe, although I feel like with trans people, I'm always hesitant with the alien thing, just because I feel like, God, born in the wrong body, can it sound more alien than that? You know, like, yeah. I've always...
It's literal.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I've bristled against that my whole life, because it's like, I don't think I was born in the wrong body. That's not the way I would ever frame my experience. I was a trans kid, you know? My body wasn't wrong, but I did need to make some adjustments to it to sort of bring it into alignment. So I don't know so much if I think about that kind of thing as much as I think about, like, a lot of people say, you know, who was your male role model, or who are your male role models, or how can we talk to boys differently about men? And I think this notion that you have to teach boys especially how to be men is very strange. Like, why can't a boy come into his sense of his gender in whatever way, you know, it makes sense for him? And why can't we equip people? Obviously, gender exists. And I am a person who embraces gender, obviously. I'm really a fan of my gender identity.
I put a lot of work into
yes,
that.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I am happy to be a man. But what I like about the way in which my masculinity has come into being is that I've gotten to shape it myself. And some things about masculinity I love. Like, I love working out. I love having muscles. I love a certain stereotypical things. But I also feel like I feel very comfortable questioning and sort of divesting from things that don't feel good to me. And being able to have that kind of liberated relationship with myself, I don't think that's something specific to being trans.
That's something everyone should have.
Yes, And so I think when men, especially when men who aren't trans get defensive or frustrated about this idea of toxic masculinity, I think it's because they don't understand what that refers to. It's a set of socialized behaviors. You learn them in boyhood. You don't have any control over that. So what really, like, what I'm advocating for is an idea around masculinity where instead of having to just live the life that you were sort of handed, that actually leads to, as far as we can tell, poor health outcomes, violence, you know, actually poor environmental outcomes because men are less likely to recycle because they see it as feminine. So these things that are actually just hurting, never mind everyone else, but also yourself, why not, like, be a little bit interested in, like, well, you know, am I comfortable with every single thing that's expected of me? Because otherwise, I'm just living this life that's constricted. And in fact, like, as people, I think most of us are interested in living a free life. So that's my pitch on why.
So take some freedom.
Exactly. Why would you not want that?
3 years later, after you appeared at Madison Square Garden, are you still getting into fights on the street?
No. I'm not getting into fights on the street, though I think about it a lot. You know, when there was in the U.S., there was this moment right after the election where there was sort of this existential question of, like, would you punch a Nazi? And so I've thought about that sort of thing quite a bit, you know, and I think I've sided on the yes side of that.
You've got the skills now.
Yes. I think I'm not interested in violence. You know, I go to, like, Quaker meetings. I'm, like, literally someone who's not violent as a core belief. But I also think one thing that surprised me about learning to fight was that, I guess the biggest surprise for me was that I now think the fact that I know how to fight, given that I was literally socialized, the fight was socialized out of me, you know, I actually think knowing that is a really important human thing. And I actually think anybody who wasn't taught to do this should learn how to do it, not so that you can walk around fighting people. And I actually think boxing doesn't encourage that at all. In fact, a big part of learning to box is learning not to fight angry. It's learning, you know, not to in any way have a temper or be engaging with this besides in the ring. But I think knowing in a more psychological way that I have it in me to fight back when I am threatened, I think that's actually, on a just sort of psychological and social way, really important. And I think it would be important for people in general and marginalized identities to know that.
Ah, it's a striking idea that people who've never been taught how to fight should discover something of that possibility in themselves. Sean, that's a leading question, isn't it? You're one of them.
I feel like I should really start with some detail. No, I do not fight people. And I don't go around punching strangers.
You just punch a cushion.
I punch a big cushion. So, yes, I do quite a lot of boxing, and I do some kickboxing as well. And I don't really know why I started doing it, but I think certainly the unexpected benefit of it is actually having a better sense of my body and what I'm actually capable of doing, which is actually a real confidence builder, like just knowing what your own body is capable of. Like, when you think about it, do you know how high you guys could jump?
No, I know. You had this story about having to jump onto orange boxes.
Yes. There was part of some of the exercises in terms of just generally getting fitter is jumping is actually quite a lot of an exertion for your body. But anyway, it's sort of the idea that actually having some sort of comprehension of what your body can do, even if you don't need to use that potential, it's actually a real lift to one's sense of confidence.
You find that it changes the way that you assert yourself in interactions that don't involve
fists. She's always punching
me. It's just non-stop abuse. It's funny, certainly in moments of confrontation, I'm certainly not a person that would ever have a physical confrontation, certainly willingly, but I feel like I hold myself with a certain amount of confidence in those situations.
As Thomas says, a lot of learning how to box is learning when not to
box.
When to, yeah,
yeah.
To
hang
back.
Yeah.
And on that note, Thomas Page McBee's book Amateur is out now with Canongate Books.
Next week, I speak to the American children's author Jason Reynolds on his poem novel The Long Way Down, as well as his new Run series about four children from different backgrounds who discover themselves while competing for a local athletics team. Now, before we go, just a moment to mention Guardian Jobs, which is sponsoring this episode of the podcast. Whether you're looking for a job yourself or you're a recruiter looking to attract candidates who are engaged with the world around them, Guardian Jobs can help you find your good company. It promotes a world of work where potential flourishes by connecting people with rewarding careers at like-minded organisations where values make the difference. So find your good company at gu.com/good company.
And do subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And join in the discussion as well on Twitter @GuardianBooks or by leaving a comment on the podcast page.
But for now, from me, Claire Armistead.
From me, Richard Lee.
And me, Sian Kane.
And our producer, Susanna Trezillian. Goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.